Order. Have a big crowd today. Thank you everyone for joining us for our February meeting of the Oregon Investment Council. This is obviously a special meeting called outside of our regular cycle. The purpose of the meeting is to hear Treasurer Reed's net zero proposal. And I want to just point out before we get started here that the treasurer does wear multiple hats. He is a voting member of the Oregon Investment Council. Also in his role as treasurer, he is ultimately responsible for the investment program at OPERF. He oversees the CIO and the team and the investment program as a whole. And so that may be considered somewhat analogous to a CEO and chair and acting as the executive in charge of the office as well as a voting member of the council. But while it is a little bit different than that, and I might be stating the obvious, he's also an elected official, as we know. So he does have political responsibilities. And I want to explicitly state that we as an investment council are not a political body. We are not to be attempting to drive political outcomes through our investment program, but rather to put our fiduciary duty and our beneficiaries first and last as well, right? That is really our only thing that we are supposed to be opining on here today. So today the treasurer is presenting to us in his capacity as head of the investment program rather than in his capacity as a member of the council. And with that, I will hand it over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Council members, I'm really excited to be in front of you, and I appreciate, Madam Chair, that introduction of the structure and the situation that brings us here today. I'm really excited to be in front of you to present this plan because it represents a really significant milestone, in my opinion, and a lot of work by a lot of people who are in this room and who are in this building and who are external as well. What we have here is a significant thing that I think really puts us on offense and allows us to continue meeting our fiduciary obligation to the people we serve. So let me first move to the slides and tell you what we're going to try to do here. To put this all in context, to give you a sense of what's in this plan and what's next. Now, I have to give you a little bit of an explanation here because I have to sort of walk a tightrope in this early stage because we have a big audience in front of us. Some people who are in the room, some people who are out, who come from a variety of different perspectives. So I'm going to say some things early in this presentation that all of you know very well. It is not intended to repeat things you already know, but an acknowledgement that some people are coming to this conversation with deep understanding about emissions and other people are expert in investments. And so I want to sort of set the stage that everybody starts from this common place. So bear with me as I tell you some things that you already know. The context here is important. We are not the sole actors in this enterprise. Working with Mr. Linick and his team and Oregon PERS to administer the actual pension system. You all as council members are policymakers, are an oversight board, and a treasury. We're responsible for the investments that deliver returns for the beneficiaries. That all matters. As does the structure of how these funds are derived and where they go. These are serving seniors on fixed incomes throughout Oregon who rely on our returns to pay for groceries and cover their utility bills. Every Oregonian has a stake in our success because a dollar that's earned in investment returns is a dollar that doesn't have to come from elsewhere in the budget. And this context matters as well. I also want to make sure that you all understand, in everyone who's listening to this is a logical step in a path that we've been on for a long time. I'm not going to read these milestones, but we've been working for quite a while to add to our capacity to integrate questions of investment risk from climate in our decision making. And what I'm describing today is the next logical step in how we continue to add to that capacity. some ground rules to start. What does net zero actually mean? I don't want anyone to be under the misimpression that this plan seeks to eliminate carbon emissions from our investment portfolio. That would not be realistic. It would not be possible. But what we are seeking is a position where those emissions that are in our portfolio are in balance with the planet's capacity to absorb them. That's what net zero means. That's the definition that the IPCC uses, and it's the one that we use as well. I also want to give you a little bit of a preview, and I'll go into some more detail on this, about how we built this plan. We prioritized engagement with stakeholders, including beneficiaries particularly, but lots of other people who have something to say and have a perspective on what we're doing here. We spent a lot of time, and there'll be quite a lot of detail about this, to understand where we are, where the emissions are in our portfolio right now, our baseline. And we've learned things from what other pensions are doing and feel very confident about this plan being in line with best practices from around the world. As we began this work, we wanted to have a thoughtful approach and really have a set of principles to return to as we confronted our choices and our design elements. This has been presented in a variety of different formats, but I like this one particularly because it has beneficiaries in the center. That is intentional. Everything we do here as counselors, as treasurer, begins and ends, as you said, Madam Chair, with the idea that we serve beneficiaries. It says beneficiaries first. They are in the center. Nothing comes before or after that. I'm quoting you in a lot of ways there. We're doing this because our ability to generate the returns that allow us to pay the benefits that public employees have earned as part of their compensation is what motivates all of this. The words around the circle are the values of Treasury, and they apply throughout our work at Treasury. They apply just as centrally to this work. And the pillars around the outside are the ones that really anchor this work. Along the bottom, there's a balance between risk and opportunity. We're trying to avoid investment risk that is presented by climate change. At the same time, we're trying to seek out opportunity that those changes represent. And we're not just about making this a paper exercise. We want to have real world impact because of the systemic risk that climate change presents to our investments. We're not scientists here. We're not questioning what scientists have done. We're seeking to apply those truths and those conclusions to the investment world. That's why we're trying to be as credible and as transparent as we can. I mentioned this work was not done in isolation. We spent a lot of time engaging with our beneficiaries to understand their preferences, their concerns. One really robust way of doing that was a survey that we sent out to about 60,000 emails. And so gratified by the nearly 10% response we got and some of the themes that emerged, particularly that people want to learn more about how we do this work. 85% of people suggested that. Two-thirds want Treasury to use our influence as an investor to encourage the places that we invest to take into account the effects of climate change on their returns. And nearly 90% of people were cognizant of the fact that we have an obligation to generate returns. So they said generate the highest returns or manage those risks to deliver sustainable returns. All of this gives us confidence that we are grounded in reality from the engagement that we did as we move forward. And there's a lot going on in this slide, but what I want you to take from this is the serious effort we took to understand where we are now. This represents the conclusions around our baseline emissions. Our colleagues from McKinsey will be up after I finish these slides to go into this in considerably more detail. The takeaway here, before I go into a little more detail, is that the asset classes along the left here look different, both because of what's in them, because of the structure and the limitations that are placed on us as investors. And so the strategies that we'll talk about are going to be different asset class by asset class. Yellow bars represent absolute emissions. And that's interesting because you can see clearly that there are more emissions in some asset classes than others. The combination of public equity and real assets, for example, 77% of the total. That's not a surprise probably to any of you, but it is revealing about where the impact is. But there's some limitations with absolute emissions because a change in the market might result in a change in absolute emissions that does not reflect a choice the investment counsel or the investment staff make. So it's more useful to look at the emissions intensity, which is defined as tons of carbon per $1 million invested. That is much easier to compare over time. So if you're looking at one set of numbers on this slide, I encourage you to look at that emissions intensity number. But again, the main point here is they're different across asset classes, and so our strategies are going to be different as well. If you are the people I know you to be, you're also looking at that asterisk and saying, what's excluded? This represents about 80%, and you might be asking, well, what's not there, and how did you decide on that? So we followed all of the PCAF, the Partnership for Carbon Accounting Financials, in determining how to measure and what to measure. And the first question really is it significant? Does it matter? Is it relevant to our climate impact as a whole? We looked at how easy and consistent it is to measure. We looked at how the role of a particular asset fits inside the broader portfolio in determining what to be in and what would be out, as well as what other pension funds are doing. And what matters here is that we got to about 80% of our portfolio. The things that were excluded, mentioned on that previous slide, are things that are shorter term. It's harder to associate emissions with cash, for example. We don't have as much influence on derivatives. And so that 80% is significantly higher than the other pension funds that have undertaken this work. And it comes with a bit of a cost because not all the same information is of similar quality across the portfolio. We had to accept the idea that we would use more proxy data in private equity, for example, but we felt really strongly that having as complete a picture as we could get as we got started was worth that cost. And so even though it is likely to be a little more noisy and a little more volatile in the early stages, we felt that was a trade worth making. So 80% is a really good number in terms of what's inside the baseline. So I'm pausing because this next slide is really the moment that I've been waiting for a long time. This is the plan. This is the details that are in it. How we're going to get to net zero by 2050, which requires an aggressive interim target of 60% reduction in emissions intensity by 2035. And this is, in my view, what we have to do to protect the pension fund and the beneficiaries. I'll go through these details, but I think they really can be categorized in three ways. We're seeking to invest more in companies that have their own plans to get to net zero, to acknowledge the reality of climate change on and its impact on their operations, to invest particularly in climate solutions that make the world's transition easier and faster, and to invest less in companies and strategies that expose us to that risk, excluding ones that are they're particularly intense. So as we go through these, we're going to triple our investments in real assets, private equity, going for climate positive investments, going from about $2 billion to $6 billion, transitioning 10% of active and 30% of our indexes to climate aligned counterparts that have the same kinds of investment characteristics and a climate alignment. Would exclude new investments in private market funds that have an exclusive focus on fossil fuels. We'll do a review of public market investments that are intense on carbon to make sure that they meet a standard for transition readiness. We use our leverage as investors to push for credible transition plans across asset classes and increase the portfolio coverage, particularly in real estate. All of this on top of work the Treasury is already doing to engage the places where we invest with partners and to make sure that just transition principles are part of that work as well. How does this look? How does this proceed? It helps me often to think of specific policy interventions in graphic terms. So that's what's intended with this slide. This is a global problem. I think everyone recognizes this. The transition to a cleaner economy and away from carbon is something that everyone is involved in, everyone is thinking about, and everyone's preparing for. So we have to acknowledge that reality. And some might say, isn't that reality reflected in the market? Isn't this already priced in? And I think the answer to that is yes, to a degree, but not adequately. So that, I think, is what is represented in line D. If we didn't do anything, that's probably the path that we're on. And that's clearly not going to get us to net zero by 2050, which is what, of course, the IPCC and the Paris Accords all refer to. So the world has recognized this and made some aspirational commitments, some plans reflected in international agreements, reflected in national commitments and policies and so on. If those policies all come to pass, and I certainly hope they do, A is probably the path that we are on. But what makes me uncomfortable about that is the reliance that it places on those policies and those aspirations coming to pass. So what you have in front of you is B, which I believe represents the responsibility that we have as individuals, as institutional investors, as fiduciaries, to take control of the things that are within our control and move more aggressively, not relying on the external government's capacity to come through on their proposals. So that's what I've described already is reflected in line B. Line C is what it would take to get to net zero by 2040. We require an 80% reduction in intensity by 2035. And much as I wish that we could do that, I don't believe that given the current state of technology and policy that is within the allowable risk limits for beneficiaries and for the plan. That may well change. I hope it does. As policies change, as technology emerges, we might be able to take a much steeper slope. And if that's true, I'll certainly be encouraging of that over time. So moving forward, I've been asked about this idea of interim targets a number of times. Some other plans have a variety of different dates. We have one interim date, 2035, before we get to 2050. And in order to do that, we have a number of different ways that we can measure our progress and track it. And looking across it, as we've already talked about, absolute emissions, the intensity of emissions, the portfolio coverage, how many of the companies, the funds, the places we invest have their own net zero plans, and what are we investing in, the kinds of technologies and solutions that are going to unlock other opportunities. These interim targets matter as well, because we don't get there all at once. We have to make sure that we are monitoring our progress along the way. So now I want to go through briefly how this strategy and this plan plays out in the different asset classes before wrapping up. Let me walk you through one of these graphs quickly, and then I'll describe how they play differently in each asset class. What we've got here is the yellow is consistent across all of them. That's the momentum, where the market is going on its own and how much that contributes to where we are, where we want to be in 2050. The other components will be different across these asset classes. Here, blue represents the effort, and some of which will happen naturally as the emissions intensity in our portfolio comes back in line with benchmarks. As a result of some of the tilts we've had over time, we've had a more intense public equity as opposed to benchmarks, and we think we're going to get some significant contributions back to net zero by just bringing that emissions intensity in line with the benchmarks over time. Here we have in the orange some gains by making sure that we are taking advantage of opportunities for investing in climate-focused products specifically, strategies that are aimed at that in particular. And in the green, there are some gains to be had, as we talked about early on, about moving some of our indexes into climate-aligned counterparts with similar characteristics and a climate commitment as well. We move to private equity again. See the gains from the momentum in yellow, We'll increase that portfolio coverage in the blue, so more of the managers have their own net zero plans. We'll see some opportunities for climate positive funds and strategies in the orange, and evolving the overall portfolio to some lower intensity sectors contributes significantly as well. In real assets, there are obviously differences here based on what is in this portfolio, but again, we'll see significant gains from momentum. We'll increase in blue the share from net, that have their own net zero plans. That contributes as well. Significant climate positive opportunities in this asset class as well. And evolving the portfolio in green towards lower intensity sectors contributes to the path as well. Real estate is vastly different because of the structure that we engage in. So the majority of the gains in this asset class come from momentum. But because of the structure, and all of these are consistent across these last elements, we have more opportunity to exert our influence and pursue specific decarbonization opportunities because of our separately managed accounts or controlling interests in a lot of cases. Where that's not true in the orange, we'll look for more coverage, more net zero plans. And finally, we are evolving towards more separately managed accounts, more controlling interests, which will drive more opportunities to engage in those decarbonization opportunities. So we want to talk a little bit briefly here, as I mentioned, of an intense, a review of carbon intense investments in public holdings. There's quite a lot of variation here, and I want Treasury to be in a position to understand those differences. So this work happens now and puts us in a better position to make decisions in the future. Creating a definition of what is in and out of these sectors around thermal coal, oil sands, shale oil and gas, defining for ourselves what a minimum standard is for transition readiness, engaging with those companies to determine who has and who meets that standard, and then connecting with those who don't. Hopefully, all of these things reduce the number of companies that we're talking about. Those that don't have it, many of them, we hope, will engage with us and begin the work to create a net a transition plan. And at the end of that, we'll be in a position to understand the differences and make decisions about how we want to proceed with companies that are not taking that risk seriously. Again, this is work that can start right now. So finally, the question really is what comes next? We've done tremendous work here. All the people that have contributed to this have put this plan in front of you and in front of the world because we have to do this, because we have to take this risk seriously and be on the offense so that we can continue to generate the returns that our beneficiaries have earned. We want you to engage with this plan, to call on the expertise of Makeda and Aon, Axia, and our other consultants, and conduct your own independent analysis. Meanwhile, there are things that I intend to do as treasurer, to begin the review that I explained, to begin preparing for the additional organizational capacity that I think Treasury is going to need to accomplish this transition, to implement this plan, to understand the pipeline of what opportunities could and should be in front of us. We're on a long pathway here, but it is important that we get started on it. You have a job to conduct independent analysis on this plan. I have a job to prepare Treasury to implement it, and I'm looking forward to that. The bottom line, colleagues, is that this risk is real. It is here for every investor, and it is an ambitious plan that we've built here, but it's the thing we have to do to meet our obligations to our beneficiaries. So I'm excited about this. I'm proud of this. I'm looking forward to the work that is yet to come. And I'm happy to take your, if there are any clarifying questions right now, I think that makes sense. But I'm also excited that our friends from McKinsey who helped us do this work are with us, Shali Vindigopal and Ryan Barrett. So maybe as you think about, if you have any quick clarifying questions, I'll invite them to join me. They're going to go through some more detail on the methodology that we used. So, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Treasurer Reed. Anyone have any questions at this moment? We do have on the agenda, after the folks from McKinsey and Company, an open discussion for the council to ask questions of both Treasurer Reed, McKinsey, and or our consultants, but anything right at the second?
Madam Chair, thank you, but I will wait.
Okay. I'll wait.
Yes, this is Madam Chair, colleagues, Shali Vindigopal and Ryan Barrett from McKinsey, who helped us go through this process, particularly with respect to the baseline and the emissions implications of the strategies that we considered. I'm glad they're here because they added considerably to our understanding of the dynamics, and I think they have some things to share about how we went about it.
Thank you.
And would you both share with us a bit of your background so we can understand what your expertise in this area is? Thank you.
Go ahead.
For the record, my name is Ryan Barrett. I'm an engagement manager at McKinsey & Company. I supported the Oregon State Treasury with technical support in the formulation of the net zero plan. My background is in sustainable finance. I was previously worked on a number of projects for many different financial institutions, banks, private equity firms, pension funds to support them in understanding how climate change is relevant to their portfolios, what the risks are involved with climate change, and also what some of the investment opportunities are.
Madam Chair, Council members, thank you for having me here today. My name is Shali Vindigopal. I'm a partner in McKinsey's sustainability practice. I've been working at the intersection of sustainability and finance for almost 15 years now. I started my career as within an investment bank and then moved over to the World Resources Institute, where I helped create some of the first draft standards around financial emissions accounting, which is one of the topics we'll be talking about today. And I also have worked since then extensively with various institutions on thinking about how climate flows in through to valuation as well as credit quality alongside net zero strategies.
Sure.
So we thought we would start with a quick presentation. Some of this will be a little bit repetitive with the presentation we saw before, but as you can tell, this space involves a lot of jargon, and so we thought it would be worth repeating. I'll be speaking for about 10 minutes before we open up to any questions, but if there's any urgent questions, feel free to interrupt me as well. As I mentioned, I've been working on this topic for over 15 years, and during that course, a lot has changed in this space. Standards are constantly evolving, and what we've seen sort of this year versus 5 years ago can change. And so many of the sort of concepts that we'll present today will bring light to some of those technicalities that we went through with the Oregon State teams during the course of this project. There's two topics in particular that we provided technical support on. One was helping to do the baseline emissions estimation that was mentioned. And then the second was to help understand the types of targets that Oregon could set, as well as the work with the investment teams to assess the feasibility of those targets. So I'll be presenting on both of those topics, and starting with the first one, to set some context here, typically any company or financial institution, when compiling what we call an emissions inventory, thinks about three types of activities. The first is the direct emissions that emanate from, you know, activities that they do directly in the course of business. The second are emissions related to purchased energy, like electricity, for example. And the third is emissions that are indirect from supply chain as well as investments. For a financial institution, typically, as you can imagine, the vast majority of these emissions, 90% and often over 95%, are coming from emissions related to investments. And that was the focus of this technical exercise. There were four steps that OST took to calculate its portfolio emissions baseline. The first was to determine the baseline scope, so what was included or excluded from the emissions calculations. And that includes thinking about asset classes as well as the instruments within those asset classes. The second was to prepare the required portfolio data, so the investment data that we received from OST's teams regarding the investments, as well as combining that with third-party data from actors such as MSCI and fund managers. The third step was to go through the process of actually calculating or estimating these emissions based on that data. And for this step, we used a methodology that is a standard for the financial institutions, for the financial sector in general, and it's called PCAF. That's the Partnership for Carbon Accounting Financials. They created the first and leading emissions accounting standard for financial institutions, and it covers seven different asset classes. This particular methodology is based on the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, which is a standard that I think many people have heard about, it because it's typically the standard that's used for corporate emissions accounting exercises. And then finally, the fourth step after applying the PCAF methodology was to validate the results. So this was essentially a QA/QC process done alongside the investment teams. Now, as we look across these four different steps, steps two, three, and four, while highly technical, complex, and time-consuming as well, was also in some sense relatively straightforward. It's a matter of taking data, applying emissions factors, validating the results. The topic that's a little bit more nuanced is number one here, which is determining what is included in the baseline scope. As Treasurer Reed mentioned, OST used various criteria to determine what to include and exclude from the baseline, and there were four factors that were considered. The first was whether OST would be able to have influence over these emissions, and also whether these emissions were material in the sense of having an impact on the environment. The second was whether there were methods available. As I mentioned, PCAF covers seven asset classes. It also does not cover certain types, explicitly does not cover certain types of asset classes and instruments, such as those held for short duration and designated for sale, short positions, or where information on individual holdings or underlying is unavailable. And then finally, OST looked towards pension fund practices. So I think the goal that we heard was that they wanted to ensure that their practices were either in line or leading relative to others in North America. So as a result of this whole exercise, as Treasurer Reed mentioned, the final emissions baseline covered about 80% of OST's assets under management. This is the highest share of AUM reported amongst the North American pension funds that have published their portfolio emissions, so the larger pension funds. And the baseline covers the full range of asset classes from public equities, fixed income, private equity, real assets, as well as real estate. The few areas that were excluded from the baseline as examples were short positions. This was actually done intentionally because typically OST would only be able to influence positive emissions, and instead they decided to cover the full long position. So it was a more of a conservative approach in that it captures more emissions. The second was asset-backed securities, as well as select REITs were not included because there was either no data on the underlying or no methodological availability. And then finally, there were some investments classified as other, cash, risk parity, and as well as risk overlay and diversifying strategies, which were excluded due to the context of those instruments. So once the baseline exercise was completed, OST then moved on to considering reduction targets against that baseline. And as Treasurer Reed mentioned, there are several different types of target setting approaches that pensions have chosen from. This is a multiple select kind of option here, so you don't have to pick one. But in OST's case and in some other financial institutions' case as well, there's typically a portfolio-wide ambition, and that might be supplemented by additional targets. So when thinking about the overall portfolio emissions target, OST considered two different types of metrics. The first was an absolute metric, so reducing emissions by a set amount without normalizing for size or growth expectations. And the second was an emissions intensity metric, which is ultimately the metric that was chosen. And this allows an entity to reduce emissions, but relative to a specific financial metric, such as assets under management or an operational metric in the case of corporate targets. And this allows an institution to account for size and growth. The last slide I wanted to cover here is just relative to other pension practices, the choice of a portfolio-wide intensity target is very much in line with the peers that were given to us to benchmark. So these include other American pension funds, as well as a group of international pension funds. And as you'll see in the top right of this slide, amongst those benchmarked, you can see that intensity-based targets are most frequently used. So once the kind of target approach was decided on, the investment teams then went through a four-step approach to assess the feasibility of these three strategies. And I'll go through them very quickly and then open it up to questions. But the essential sort of purpose of this exercise was to test different bookends. So one was a bit more of an incremental scenario in which OST took incremental action over what we kind of viewed as a business as usual pathway. The second was aiming for 60% reductions by 2035, which is in line with the ultimate target chosen. And then finally testing a 2040 net zero timeline, which implied about 80% intensity reductions by 2035. Once those bookends were determined, the investment teams listed a range of net zero actions that could be taken by asset class and defined starting point assumptions so that we could calculate what the sort of incremental versus other scenarios looked like. And finally, these sort of calculators were iterated on in order to understand what mix of asset classes and what mix of actions could make sense in order to achieve each of these strategies. So we went through this exercise in close collaboration with the investment teams, and ultimately OST sort of took this information and decided to form their plan. So thank you so much again for the opportunity, and very happy to answer any technical questions on the plan.
Appreciate the work, the level of detail, the comprehensive nature, and also just the level of transparency. We strive to be transparent and continue to get more transparent, so that's very. I will start with a question, and appropriate person answer it, please. But one of the reason that this is coming before us today is, in my understanding, so please correct me if I'm wrong, that climate change presents a real risk to our investments and also presents opportunities. Risk to our various investments in different asset classes is not always defined by carbon emissions. So, for example, one of the examples that the treasurer used in his written information, not presented here, was insurance companies. Insurance companies are not large carbon emitters, but they suffer significant risk from climate change if they have a concentrated geographic exposure in an area that takes a big hit. Similarly, another example would be real estate. There might be a building that is LEED certified that has used some sort of low emissions concrete, new technology, but is in a location that presents significant physical risk. So I'm seeing sort of risk in this plan and report defined by the amount of carbon that any specific company is emitting into the atmosphere, as opposed to specific risks that climate events may have on that investment. And I'm just wondering how that works.
Madam Chair, thanks for the question. I think you make a really good point. First off, you're 100% on target that the reason behind this plan is the investment risk that we see from climate change. And I think you are also smart to point out the different ways that plays out. This plan is built, I think, specifically around carbon emissions, but I think that does not mean that we are going to stop paying attention to those other risks as they present themselves elsewhere in the portfolio. And as I mentioned early on, this is the next step in an evolution we're continuing to try to make to improve our capacity to integrate those factors throughout. In my mind, this is not the only thing we're going to do. This is big. This is significant. This is worthy of consideration on its own. But it doesn't mean our other efforts are going to stop. So I think it all is moving in a similar direction.
If I could just add some technical nuance. We typically think about climate risks in two buckets. One is physical risks, as you mentioned, and the other is transition risks. In the transition risk bucket, we think about exposure to policy, technology changes, market trends, and other kind of evolution. Typically, when you do your emissions measurement and you understand what that sort of tons of CO2 number is, it's useful to inform exposure to the transition risk. It's less useful to inform exposure to physical risk. So I think it's worth noting. However, there's obviously a relationship between the two, because if society does not reduce emissions today, those physical risks can manifest, exponentially in the future. But the nature of physical risks is also a little bit different, because it tends to be volatile with extreme weather events and such, in addition to kind of longer term impacts. So just wanted to add a technical nuance.
Go ahead.
Treasurer Reed, one of the questions on my mind not to be answered today, I think we'll need to think carefully this and have advice from our consultants, all of those things, have advice from legal. There's additional steps here, right, and information to be considered. But, I wonder how specifically are targeting specific investments, the increased amount in real assets and I think private equity that are sustainable or climate friendly investments, the exclusion of new carbon intensive investments, how that fits with our policies. And the policy, I can't quote it exactly, but it's basically our investment objectives are to get the highest risk-adjusted returns. So, how do you foresee kind of marrying the, if a carbon-intensive investment has the highest risk-adjusted return in one of the asset classes, how does excluding that meet our current investment objectives of having the highest returns for retirees? Right now we've got ESG language and, our policies that say we will consider additional factors, right? And so there's additional factors to the highest risk adjusted return, because if we really believe that we won't get the highest risk-adjusted return because of those factors, that would lead us to say, well, it's not, that investment is not the highest one after you really consider these risks. And we're doing that now, as I understand it. So I may not be posing this question but as clearly as I would like, but this is the question on my mind that the council really has to have more information and consider carefully.
Madam Chair, Councilor Arvin, I think I get the gist of what you're asking. I think you're being hard on yourself because you're pointing at the right tension here. For me, the question is always, how do we make the funds as productive as possible? But I think the key is over time. There are lots of elements that make individual investments more or less attractive over shorter periods of time. And of course, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. Our objective is to maximize risk-adjusted returns over the long term. And that, I think, is the key here. You're right to point out that we have articulated our belief in ESG factors in our investment beliefs. And I think this is a natural evolution of that to make sure that we are more specific and more effective. I think clearly the next step for this plan is independent analysis from the council and consultants. I feel very confident and proud of this work, but the way to make it stand up is to have the independent analysis that you're describing. So there's lots more work to be done. I think it all sticks together and is consistent.
I have a whole list of questions here, and so they may not be in any rational order. So one of the things that I kind of struggle with, and having you all here, maybe you have some thoughts on this, is that a large portion, if the goal here is to reduce our exposure to emissions, carbon emissions, and if that's something we feel we all want to do, a lot of this plan is incumbent upon those companies in which we are invested having net zero trajectories themselves, plans, and also achieving them. And so we do have the information here, thank you very much, about who has them. We also know that most countries and companies are not actually on track to achieve their plans. And some of the information in the board book had to do with the fact that the International Energy Agency foresees demand for fossil fuels continuing to grow for at least the next two decades, because we know that supply of all things is driven by demand, and we as consumers across the globe continue to consume more energy, both per capita and on an absolute basis. And so as long as we are all in this room and around the globe growing our energy consumption and demand, how is it possible that the world, the companies meet these plans?
Madam Chair, I didn't want to interrupt you. You're right. I mean, this all is in a global context, and it would be foolish and presumptuous to say that our actions in the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund by itself are going to solve the challenge of climate change. That's not what you're suggesting.
Let me back up from there, because that's not.
I know.
I'm just suggesting that if our plan is dependent on companies out there achieving net zero, as long as we're all consuming more energy, that I don't foresee that yellow portion of the graph going where we're suggesting it's going.
I didn't mean to put words in your mouth that you weren't saying. I was setting that up to say that I agree with you that we are not acting alone here. There are a lot of vulnerabilities that depend on actions that others are going to choose, whether they're individuals, aggregated individuals, governments, countries, and the like. But we have a responsibility, I think, to be on offense and to be in control of the things that we can. And the other thing that I'm 100% certain of is that when we get to 2050, 26 years from now, whatever our best intentions are, even if we all completely agreed on this and we're 100% certain about this, this is not going to be what actually transpires over the next 26 years. But this plan gives us a chance to be on offense, to take control of the things that we can control, and it will have to adjust as policies change, as technologies emerge, as the world changes. It's incumbent upon future treasurers and councils to adjust to that reality as well. But I believe it is far better for us to get started on this path and to have the work underway so that we are not letting others further define the options that are available to us, and that beneficiaries have more vulnerability.
Kevin.
A question more for McKinsey. In your studying of other pension plans that are going through this, the one thing that I see is this two paradigms where no ESG considerations, old divestment, whatever. And I'm seeing lawsuits coming from either side, both on the same sort of vein where you're reducing the investment, thus you're breaching your fiduciary duty. What are you seeing out in the markets and other public sector plans such as ourselves that lead you to find that path that truly does take into account the fact that there is climate change and we need to make some changes without exposing, for the better way, our assets to multiple lawsuits?
Happy to take that. So, you know, I think without sort of opining on which plans are better and not better, I think the broad thing that we've seen sort of from our client service is that typically institutions go through specific steps even as they announce a commitment to actually have that commitment come into play. And one of the first steps is focusing more on the risk side and the fiduciary side in incorporating climate change factors into risk processes. That's the true with pension funds. We've also seen it with banks. We've seen it with private equity. That's sort of like kind of the first step to making sure that climate considerations are taken into account. The second step is what we like to call signposting. So ensuring that you have a good sort of process and track for keeping abreast of policy, technology, and other trends. Going back to Treasurer Reed's point about playing offense, I think sometimes these shifts happen quite rapidly and substantially. We've seen that with the Inflation Reduction Act and BIL as well, which are expected to sort of, you know, permeate through the market in coming years. I don't think many people realized, even in the process of the sort of introduction of that legislation, how big a impact it would have on certain markets. And so that sort of keeping abreast of those kind of trends is sort of the second and important task in front of a lot of pension funds. I think the third, and, you know, I think part of this is just sort of the timing by when people had, so pension funds and other financial institutions has gone through the process of setting the targets, is that in the past, some of these exercises had been, let's throw our hat over the wall and then figure out how to climb the wall later, or even how high the wall is. And I think that we have seen, especially in North America, that sentiment changing quite substantially. And I think you sort of saw that in the process that OST went through, that there's a much keener eye towards feasibility analysis. And this actually goes back to, Madam Chair, one of your questions about how do you consider the fact that there's a reliance on companies having to not only set these targets, but not all of them are going to meet these targets, right? I think I've seen statistics that say only 13% of companies have met their net zero plan targets. That is something that the investment teams took into account in doing the feasibility analysis, those assumptions of how companies in different sectors might have differential adoption of the targets and also success in achieving those targets as well. And I think that's something very important to keep track of over time, because it will flow through to the sort of ultimate feasibility of the targets.
Madam Chair,
yes,
good morning. Good morning. Hey, I'm just going to pick up on that thread of, can you hear me? Yes. Okay. I'm just going to pick up on that thread of playing offense. And so I'm going to anchor my questions around next steps. And so, Treasurer Reed, you highlighted capacity building would be keyed to the implementation plans. What are some of the initial costs, estimates, and timeline? So that's one question, and I'll wait for your response for the next one.
Sure. Madam Chair, Councillor, we're about a month away from the early stages of developing Treasury's 25-27 budget proposals that will go in front of the legislature with a future treasurer. I think this plan will certainly be part of those considerations. The legislature might want to weigh in that conversation as well. But we're, you know, it's a bit premature to be too specific, but I think it's clear that we're going to need some additional brains and capacity inside Treasury to take this work on. And that's a big part of the next steps, as well as being part of the analysis that follows here.
Okay, thank you. And one last question here, and still on next steps. Mm-hmm. I know in your written proposal, you mentioned establishing a net zero advisory committee. Mm-hmm. I'll use the term committee, and somewhere around sometime this year, I will say. Can you speak to the composition, kind of the role, the responsibility, kind of the purpose of the committee? What are you envisioning there?
Madam Chair, Councillor, we got a lot out of the engagement that we conducted in constructing this plan, and I think the body that we contemplate in the plan follows on that. So I think we're a ways away from having the specific numbers or identities in mind, but the idea of making sure that beneficiaries have a mechanism to make sure that we are aware of their concerns and priorities as we pursue implementation here. An advisory committee, I think, will be useful to Treasury and to me as we continue this work, and that's really the intent here. We've got some good momentum through the building of this plan, and we want to continue that.
Did that answer your question, Pia?
Yeah, thank you.
Following on Pia's question about cost, you mentioned potentially going to the legislature. We do have finite resources, and those are given to us from the legislature. To the extent that we have finite resources and all resources that we use for one task, goal, or priority are no longer available for another, How do you weigh the costs and human capital needs of this exercise with potential other needs that the investment division has as it pertains to investment officers, risk officers, what have you?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I don't think this plan introduces any new levels of budget competition that exists already, and it will be along the same lines of understanding what Treasury's needs are for the short and long term, and putting those together in a way that is compelling and meets those needs in the best possible balance. Remember, when we go to the legislature, we're not one major advantage the Treasury has is that we are not competing with other general fund priorities. So we don't legislators don't have to pit Treasury against education or human services or public safety. We have to have a compelling story about how we are taking on Treasury's needs as a whole, and that's something we are well prepared to do, I think, and we will.
Going here, the survey, collecting the beneficiaries' feedback, as well as making a committee, maybe composed entirely of beneficiaries or somewhat of beneficiaries, so we can get their feedback. Another way that we get beneficiary feedback is just seeing how they are allocating their retirement dollars within PERS in those parts of the program where they have options. So, for example, the individual account program, the IAP, they allocate their own dollars. And within that program, there are, I don't know exactly what they're called off the top of my head, but they're ESG options, climate-aligned types of funds. Oh, sorry, OSGP. I apologize. Oregon Savings Growth Plan. So that would be an instance where they're voting with their dollars, not just with their check marks in a survey. Can you tell us, or do you have data on what percentage of either the assets or the humans participating in that sort of option selection choose to invest in ESG aligned or climate aligned funds?
Madam Chair, I don't have the precise number. I know it's quite small, but I think it is, it's a challenge to make that a direct comparison because while I'm not perfectly current on the menu there, I think the last time I looked, it was TIAA's social choice. And again, I think their methodology is relatively blunt around excluding certain classes of equities and investments. Whereas what we're proposing here is a much more comprehensive way of taking into account the risks, the investment risks that climate change represents. So I think there's some use in that, but I don't know that it's a direct comparison.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I don't want to keep taking up the microphone, but I think some of these things are important for everyone to hear. Kevin, go ahead.
Oregon Savings Growth Plan as of September 30th, socially responsible investment option had 4,003,000 participants out of about 45,000 participants and 1.4% of plan assets. The challenge to all of this is in some cases fees, and other cases there's a lot of different options and a lot of people just go to basically the life path or target date funds as the default. So there's not a great take up, but there is interest, and I couldn't tell you if it's growing or not. But again, there are two types of people that are in the world as far as financial planning. One's conscientious planners and one is confused avoiders. 90% are confused avoiders, so they take the easy way out and go to a default fund. That's my history of watching capital accumulation plans. So sometimes it's misinformed or sometimes it's just easy to go to the default.
Madam Chair, certainly there's some other people too, right? Those who are humble people who know that the life paths are well constructed. And
they are that, yes, too.
Thank you. That's helpful, Kevin.
This just one of your questions brought this to mind, but just that, you know, with the staffing that would be needed really to really implement this plan, I'm assuming that would be developed in a transition plan, right?
Yes.
But there's kind of the chicken and the egg, because a transition plan, at what point would that be developed, a proposed transition plan, and how would that align with the budget cycles of really, you know, the state committing more resources really to Treasury to be able to enact this plan? So it's hard to imagine, you know, endorsing a plan, not knowing the transition plan or that the resources have been allocated. And so, and I don't know what the budget cycles of how that works and if there's times you can request more money off cycle, but if you could enlighten me a little bit on that.
Madam Chair, Councilor, we built this plan with the intention of going as fast as we can to address the investment risks of climate change without prompting a need for a policy change or a recasting of the strategic asset allocation. Within that context, we go in front of the legislature and seek adoption of our fees, essentially, and the number of positions that we're allowed to hire. So I imagine that as part of the preparation for the 25-27 legislative session, this would be a big part of that conversation. Meanwhile, I hope and expect that the Investment Council is going to take up its own independent analysis of the plan with the help of Makita and Aon and Axia and others. And all of this, of course, is dependent on the next treasurer, whomever she or he is, continuing along this path, and all of you who will continue on the council. But I don't think that there are significant make or break dates in this process. This is going to be an evolution. We're talking about 26 years here that we're starting a path on, and we're in a good position to have that conversation in ways that are going to be thoughtful and put us in a great position to succeed.
For one more specific question, mm-hmm. if you were continuing to push this forward as quickly as you could,
yep.
When would you be, you know, assuming if you had endorsement, when would you be putting forth proposals and requests for funding of additional positions?
Well, that process starts in about a month from now, getting ready for the 25-27 session. And those details, we've begun those conversations with the investment division, and that'll be part of the process for us. Yeah.
Another question for McKinsey. One of the things that's in this for a tactic is to go to more climate-friendly index funds. Years ago, they used to be quite expensive because of just, you know, excluding companies and everything else. Has the opportunity set increased such that it's much more cost efficient in how you get into these index funds from a passive perspective as we move across?
Over the last, I would say 5 years has been, I guess, a tremendous growth in the amount of interest in these funds from asset owners, and asset managers are starting to respond with the supply of different products. I think we've seen the biggest growth, particularly in private markets. A number of the big GPs, private equity firms operating in those markets, I think have been some of the first to construct funds that are focused on climate impact, focused on companies that stand to benefit from a rapid transition, whether they're in renewables, in transmission distribution, hydrogen, climate technology and software, these various elements. We have seen some index providers, examples. Some of the largest global index data companies and firms, they've constructed indexes that attempt to skew investments towards companies which have ambitious net zero commitments and are meeting those commitments, and are doing that in a systematic way and making those options available for asset owners to invest in those indexes. As to the specific costs for those funds relative to others, I couldn't comment specifically on those.
Patricia Reed, your comment kind of got to the meat of the issue here. I could ask a million questions about how the plan would work, but the real issue is, what for us, for the council, what is our role in this? So what I heard you say in response to Lorraine's question was our goal in putting this forward was that we were looking to put forward a plan that would not require changes in OIC policy. I also read in the plan and heard in your comments today a lot of we will and we are, which again suggests that these are things that can be done and will be done. They don't necessarily require the input of the council. We are a policy setting council. The things that we are focused on are asset allocation, right? Risk. We set benchmarks. We sent risk budgets for some of the asset classes. Capital markets assumptions, these types of things. And last year you saw that we really tried to do some extra work delineating the roles and responsibilities of OST versus council, and really pointing out that the Treasury staff is responsible for investment decisions. Mm-hmm. And so I do imagine that there are things in this plan that can be done, to the extent that the investment team believes that is the best investment path to achieve the goals in line with the policies that we have set. another thing that we did in the last couple of years is try to take out of our policies anywhere that investment strategy was proscribed. So we used to say we want a small cap tilt, we want a value tilt, and we removed those things to really say, no, we want the investment team to decide at any given time what is the best way to meet the risk-adjusted return goals within this asset allocation. So I cannot say that I agree with you that 100% of this plan can be achieved without any, you know, policy change or benchmarking change from the council, but tell me what you think you need from us, what you don't need from us, what are the things you feel you can and will move forward with, where do we need to chime in?
Madam Chair, that's a really good summary of the role and the place I think we are in. You summarized it accurately. We're trying to go as fast as we can without prompting those things. But we want your independent analysis, informed by consultants, to confirm that. That is the logical way to test this plan, to move it forward. There are clearly things, in my view, that we can move forward with inside Treasury. The review of carbon-intensive public holdings is a clear example of that for me. We can do that work. That's research that allows us to be in a better position to make decisions. I think there are other places that are also clear, but that's the logical next step here, is the independent analysis from the council to grapple with this and take this on. And so that's my ask as we come out of this meeting, is to use appropriate time and resources from inside Treasury and from our external consultants to analyze the plan with an external, well, with multiple external sets of eyes.
So this may be a question more for Mr. Marlowe. But I think one thing the council, or I feel is important, and maybe other council members do too, is really a legal opinion or legal analysis as to the policy issue and other statutory type issues. And that would also include some type of legal risk analysis, you know. As Kevin mentioned, there's been, you know, litigation in other cases. So where is that? Is that in progress? When the council have some information? How? You know, what do you know about that?
How are you?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. And perhaps I can even elicit some expert testimony here from our experts here. So I think legal implications are going to be included in this analysis. So, and it will be an important factor we could have. And so actually, I guess I'll ask our experts, maybe if they can explain or what they know, because I think there's a precedent that's going on right now. There's a complaint against the New York City pension plan, so in which case there was a decarbonization actions taken. So I don't know if you can explain what the complaint's about there, or you know what you know and where we're at. I checked yesterday, by the way. I think there are motions back and forth. So there's a complaint filed against the board in that case. So.
I'm sadly not a lawyer, and I think Ryan isn't either. I think the context we have is probably just as much as you have from the news articles. But I think to summarize, there's a concern that you know, New York City's policies would be, in some sense, violating fiduciary duty. So, anything to add?
Okay. Right. I'll add. So the complaint is that the actions taken, you know, by that board. Violated the statutes in that case, New York City, fiduciary duties. So the prayer for relief was actually to void their decision. So the board made its decisions, sold assets, and then so the court is now getting to consider, frankly, taking the decisions away from the board since they violated their duty and appointing a new fiduciary. So that would be, I think, in the worst case sense, worst case scenario, that would be the consequence. If we, I guess we'll say, do this wrong. So you end up making the decision, having a party then complain that we did it wrong, and the judge then says, we don't get to make the decisions anymore. We will appoint a new person to be the fiduciary. You know, any bank, for example, could be a fiduciary. So yes, I think, you know, the policy, and once we get the policy to consider legal, not just myself, but the Department of Justice, in-house Treasury Counsel, can frankly give you the opinion as to, you know, what we estimate. Are we within the parameters? So, you know, we won't take any action until you get our opinion on that. Because I think the consequences are definitely a possibility. So the motions are going back and forth, as I checked yesterday. And because I think the case was filed in September of last year. So and so it's ongoing. So thankfully we're not the first. I think we have some example to go on. So, and I guess while I have the microphone, I would actually just go back to our experts here while you're here. Maybe you could talk more. The Securities and Exchange Commission, for example, has proposed rules in 2022. So maybe, okay, so because your analysis on the PCAF, for example, using the baselines, maybe you can explain those rules, for example, that I think would provide standardization uniformity more than what we have now. Are they valuable? They go to disclosures of emissions. And so would that change then the use of PCAF or the other, I think you referred to the greenhouse gas protocol data. Yeah. Would the Securities and Exchange, would the new rules then change essentially the foundation of the data? So maybe you can explain more about the Securities and Exchange Commission's actions on this.
Yeah, absolutely. Just on your last topic, and Treasurer Reed can probably speak to maybe the differences in your plan versus New York City's first, and then I can jump in on.
Thanks. Yeah, I think I'm always loath to. I don't like it when other people comment on Oregon's strategies without having a high level of understanding. So I'm loath to do that too much with New York City. But I think I'm not a lawyer. But as I read about these, a lot of the complaints are around the process that leads to decisions, and are they solidly motivated by avoiding risk and generating returns, not on other political factors. So I'm confident in saying that is a big part of where complaints and disputes arise. And I'm really confident in the process that we've engaged in here that is focused on financial returns, how we avoid risk, how we generate returns. And I think that will put us, if that ever happened, on much stronger grounds because of the comprehensive way we've built this plan. It's not predetermining an outcome or a decision on an individual investment. It is about the methodology that we would use to make decisions. And I think that if we get to that point would be significant.
So just going back to the SEC proposed rule, I think as context, it's not clear when the rule will be finalized. Most recently, we heard that it would be, I think in this quarter of 2024. So I think people are waiting the final form of the rule. The original rule as proposed included disclosure of scope 1, 2, as well as 3 emissions. Those include those categories I mentioned before, direct as well as indirect emissions, and would conceivably then include investment-related emissions. I do not know if the final rule will also include those Scope 3 emissions, but from our read of the proposal, that emissions accounting would be based on greenhouse gas protocol standards from which PCAF standards are derived. And from my expertise, we are not aware of any other standards that are as far-reaching as the PCAF standards, so the chances of the standards themselves changing are relatively low, at least on the emissions front. Can't predict, but that's our sense. The SEC proposed rule, however, also includes several other components that are derived from these emissions calculations, and those range from evaluating transition risk, which I talked about before, and also evaluating the materiality on your financial sort of specific line items from the impacts of climate change in a given year. For all of those types of calculations, you may be relying on that emissions accounting exercise.
And just to add, there are similar initiatives in California is one that has rules proposed to also expand the scope of reported emissions from companies. I think you can think of the PCAF standards as a way to almost like a guidebook on how to interpret and understand the what emissions for a financial institution means and how to inform the figures that are ultimately reported within a regulatory disclosure.
Thank you for the presentation and the time you've put into this. Appreciate it. To the McKinsey experts, this is more of a question out of curiosity. How, in your experience, or is there in your experience, some thought, some thinking around diversification of risk through the lens of this climate change? So now everything, I was just looking at the plan and it's all focused on, you know, carbon emissions and bringing that down. Is there any, are there any methods or any thinking around risk diversification such that we're not adopting this one way of addressing climate change? And this is kind of, you see what I'm saying? The same way we have diversification of asset classes, like in this, from the risk perspective, are there different ways?
Yeah, I think if I were to restate your question, how do we think about risk diversification in this context of climate conscious investing? And I would say, I think just generally, climate change impacts a lot of sectors in a lot of different ways, both directly, but also through knock-on impacts. You know, I mentioned, for example, when we sort of think about transition risk and exposure to policies, for example, regulating fossil fuels, you might think that, okay, this is definitely going to affect the airlines industry, but that has a knock-on impact on airports and jobs associated with airports. So it sort of trickles down through the economy in various ways. As we sort of consider sustainable investing in general, so not in this particular context, there are several different sectors across the whole economy that can provide that base of diversification. There are, of course, sort of, you know, I think differing opinions on how to think about the right risk diversification mix when you consider fossil fuels. As Madam Chair mentioned, even under net zero scenarios, there is an expectation, for example, that natural gas will continue to be a main source of fuel. And so the, you know, context of diversification needs to be sort of like nuanced and thought about in the context of like what an appropriate transition is as well. I hope that answers your question at a high level.
And now drilling that down to us sitting here, can you not hear me? Sorry, I have a cold. As the trustees for pension funds, I think where I'm coming from is I'm thinking about what you were saying, Lorraine, around the risk-adjusted returns, and just kind of all these comments. I don't get the sense, and this is I'm learning, I'm still new to this space, that there's been a focus on that diversification of risk. And I guess maybe it has to do with the structure of the instruments that we're thinking through. It could be you've been limited by the policies that are existing already. I think maybe zooming out, if you had a blank slate, how would you approach it? So that as we think about this for the next coming months, and we think about our fiduciary duty, and we think about these risk returns, having some sense of what is out there. It may not be that we adopt them, but just having some thinking around that.
So
is that clear, by the way? I'm thinking as I talk. I hope it's clear.
It's okay, we all do that.
Yes.
I think it's somewhat clear. I will say we obviously, as McKinsey, cannot provide investment advice in general. So that's my caveat before we kind of provide some thoughts on this topic. But look, I think when we talk about risk-adjusted returns, we have to also consider that climate itself is a source of risk. And so doing that sort of, as I mentioned, like base evaluation of how climate can manifest into risk in your portfolio over several different horizons is kind of an important exercise to undertake. And that we've seen sort of as best practice amongst our clients to think about climate in the context of the entire risk mix. Of course, if you are making sort of portfolio allocation decisions that favor some sectors over another, that needs to be balanced with sort of other investments and other strategies, which we can't sort of go into in a lot of detail, but perhaps you have more to add here.
Well, one other thing to add, and I don't know if this is too simplistic an interpretation of what you were saying, but there's a way that diversification plays out in this plan in the sense that we're talking about investing more in climate solutions, investing in less in things that are contributing more investment risk as a result of emissions, engaging with those companies, particularly in collaboration with other institutional investors, both to have more of an impact and to send a market signal that we want more of these products. That is a form of diversification, I suppose, too, in that we're not putting all of our efforts here in one specific strategy or technique. I don't know if that's responsive, but I think that's important, too.
We don't need to talk too much about it. I think where I was coming from is it's all based on reducing those carbon emissions. So whether we're going towards more climate friendly investments versus divesting from others, it's still that baseline is going to be around the carbon emissions. And I think I was just wondering, it comes to the point, I don't know if it's Madam Chair who brought it up, we're basically counting on those partners to meet their net zero plan. So I was thinking from that perspective, like how do we diversify that risk knowing that some of the players and actors may not meet their targets? And I was just trying to think like what else could we do beyond baselining on those carbon emissions? We don't have to spend too much time on it, but that's where I was coming from.
Sorry, I think I understood your question backwards. So I apologize for the previous response. It sounds like you are trying to mitigate the risk of not achieving those emissions reductions targets. And there's a whole range of actions that institutions can take to meet their net zero targets beyond sort of depending or passively hoping that other companies, and investees set their own targets and meet them. And those include, engagement with the companies, with the fund managers. Through the fund managers, it includes, working with other institutional investors to ensure that there's a level playing field. It includes ensuring that there's clear standards and data and sort of best practices that are taken into account. And, one of those things to kind of reduce the risk is by considering risk in the decision making as well.
Thank you. on the topic of risk, excuse me, sorry. These are good questions. I started out with saying sort of this is very focused on meeting certain emission standards, and carbon emissions are not necessarily where the risk lies for us in terms of our investments. I do want to point out, just to out of respect for our staff and the work that they do, that when we're evaluating investments in any industry, we should be looking at, and I believe our talented people are looking at, the risks associated with those things, which aren't necessarily all financial and economic, right? So may the government change reimbursement for prescription drugs, right? May we crack down on opioid use? Geopolitical risks, right? Might there be a civil issue in one of the countries in which we're invested? Might we go to war with China? All of these things, is there legal risk? Is there policy risk? Could be in any number of things. Are there bad actors involved with the companies that could blow up? And risks associated with weather events, climate events, are and should be included in those efforts. And I know that they are doing that today. When our real assets team makes an investment, let's say in an oil and gas producing property, they are looking at the expected timeline of that producing property, when how many years it's supposed to be in production, to whom is it sending the oil, where is the demand coming from, what are their mitigation plans at that property. So I just want to point out that, you know, as it pertains to what are the risks of my specific investments, to the extent that our team is doing due diligence on individual investments, they ought to be thinking about this the same way they think about, is consumer demand growing or going away? And to the extent that we delegate those investment decisions to fund managers, active managers, outside managers, it is our job as staff, and I believe our staff is doing it, to insist and hold those managers accountable to considering all the risks of those investments as well, which may or may not be, are you, you know, reducing your carbon emissions, but, you know, government policies are changing for your industry, whatever that industry is, and how are you taking those into effect? So I want to make sure that we just recognize that that is something that we do. If it's not, boy, we better start doing it yesterday. And sort of to, so that we're not starting from a place of, you know, wow, this is something that we're not thinking about and we're in a lot of trouble. So I guess just to kind of try to move this along, what I see in my head for us as next steps as a council, you know, the treasurer mentioned he feels that a lot of these things are investment decisions that can be made. What I think a lot of what Lorraine spoke about is what we need to do, which is to say, okay, this is what you all would like to do. Do we feel that there are actions in here that would be in violation of our policies? And really, in order to do that, we are going to need the help of our general consultants at Aon and Makita. They both have departments that address, you know, climate and ESG issues. They advise on those things for a lot of their clients. So we need to look at that. And then we need to come to you and say, we don't feel that these actions, these specific actions, would be in alignment with our policies. Therefore, we need to have a discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, you can lobby us to change our policies. We can decide whether and when we think that is in the best interests of our beneficiaries. We also, you know, will pursue legal feedback, both outside counsel and internal counsel, about, you know, what are the legal risks for staff and for the council, mm-hmm. for moving forward on any of these things. I think that we've acknowledged that the folks at McKinsey are experts in the emissions side of things and thinking about these risks and financing of emissions. I think we need our investment experts to say, okay, we understand that these changes will impact our emissions in this way. That's a positive from that perspective, but how might they impact our returns? So we need the investment side, which I know to some extent is staff, but I think we would like the outside advice of consultants to say, we believe that these actions would have a positive impact on your risk-adjusted returns, or a negative impact, or they might increase your volatility or diminish your volatility. We're going to need that,
that.
As well. And then I think that also requires a deep dive by potentially some of the specific asset class consultants to say, okay, within private equity, based on the contracts that we have and the managers that are out there, you know, this is or is not achievable and or over what time frame. So I think in my mind, those are our next steps. I do feel like maybe there was a suggestion in some of the plan of changing benchmarks, because if we are changing the indexes that we are using, I wasn't sure if you thought that that would mean we ought to or not, but it, in the event that that is a suggestion, I feel that that is also strongly within our purview to determine.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't think that's the intent, but certainly that could be a good part of the analysis that you described.
Does that feel in alignment with your hopes and goals.
I'm sure it does. I was nodding as you were describing it. That's exactly what I think should happen. Your description is good. We relied on our friends from McKinsey for emissions expertise. We relied on internal treasury capacity for investment expertise, but that needs the external scrutiny that you described. And that's very much in alignment with my hopes.
Anyone on the council, did council members agree that is the appropriate path to take? Yeah.
Yes, I had to get off the mute.
Thank you.
Yes, the analysis and an outside opinion, yes. I'm kind of still back to the diversification, but we can kind of work through that with the outside counsel, because I think it was an excellent question, as well as Lorraine questions. Bottom line, yes, I agree.
Okay. So at this point, we are going to move to public comments, and we did not have a break in the agenda, but I would like to ask for a 5-minute break, coming back at 10:40, at which point we will take public comment. I will call up three people at a time. We have quite a few speakers today. We'll start with Mike Powers, Monica Weathersby, and Sarah Wolford. And as you begin your comments, please state your name and the organization that you are with, or the topic that you are representing, before you start your comments. And we will try to be respectful of time. I will be the keeper of the time up front. Let's see, we have Mike, we have Sarah, do we have Monica? Oh, she's coming. Okay. I will let you start, Mr. Powers.
Thank you very much. Chair Samples, can you hear me? Chair Samples, Treasurer Reed, council members, thank you for the opportunity to comment on the treasurer's proposed a pathway to net zero. My name is Mike Powers, and I'm president of SEIU Local 503. We represent over 70,000 workers. Well over 20,000 of them are current workers who are vested in the public employee retirement system. Our union members include many PERS retirees. We appreciate Treasurer Reed's and his staff's work to develop this 2050 net zero plan. It is a good step forward. And overall, we are in support. We ask the OIC to take a critical look at this proposal and develop any policies needed to implement it. A secure retirement and reversing global warming continue to be some of our members' greatest concerns. We are encouraged by the proposal to analyze most of the damaging fossil fuels. We are encouraged by the proposal to analyze how the most damaging fossil fuels threaten OPERF returns, notably thermal coal, frack gas, oil sands, and shale oil and gas. We appreciate the attention paid to reviewing the risk to the portfolio from stranded assets. We're also encouraged that Treasury has included private equity in the emissions estimates. This will provide an important tool for avoiding risky long-term investments in the highest emitting projects. We fully support the Treasurer's Net Zero Beneficiary Advisory Committee and commit to participate. We ask that the OIC ensure that this committee is set up to help guide actions and bring external accountability on the path to a net zero portfolio. The plan recognizes that the UN Climate Change Conference in Paris calls for global emissions to reach net zero by 2050 to keep global warming to 1 degree Celsius. We also know that the UN Secretary General has warned that we must slow global warming more aggressively and to commit to reaching net zero as close to 2040 as possible. Therefore, we strongly encourage Treasury to actively look at opportunities to ramp up transition where it also meets fiduciary responsibility. One option to consider is to cut emissions intensity by 60% prior to 2035 instead of by 2035 as proposed. I have more things to say, but I'm running out of time. One other thing I would like to say to ensure is that Treasury and the OIC will need to update their approach to investment managers, ensuring that incentives and accountability includes active management for net zero goals, as well as long-term financial returns. Again, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Excellent. Okay. Good morning, members of the Oregon Investment Council. My name is Monica Weathersby, and I am the OEA Equity Director, a newly created elected position within OEA's leadership team. I am here today to share some thoughts from the OEA Board of Directors on the Net Zero Investment Plan. As PERS beneficiaries, we are very interested in the strength and longevity of PERS. Educators across the state, many in low-wage jobs, rely on PERS to help make ends meet after retirement. The OEA Board is glad to see the Treasury addressing the impact of climate change on the PERS investments and leveraging the power of the PERS to help make changes that will benefit future generations. We understand the need to make investment changes carefully and slowly in order to ensure that beneficiaries have what they were promised from the PERS system. For Oregon educators, addressing the climate crisis is not just an abstract goal. It's a real concern we hear from the students we work with in classrooms and lecture halls across the state every single day. The state treasurer's net zero plan is an ambitious move in the right direction for the sustainability of our planet, while also maintaining on the strength of the PERS fund for current and future beneficiaries. We look forward to collaborating with the OIC now and in the future on implementing and maintaining fidelity to the net zero plan. We appreciate Treasurer Reed's stakeholder outreach and encourage continued stakeholder engagement that actively seeks to both get input from stakeholders and share updates as the plan is rolled out. We would like to see more information about how to ensure fidelity to the plan as Treasurer's OIC members change and for how continued communication with stakeholders will occur. For example, clarity on questions like how will the Net Zero Beneficiary Advisory Committee be selected? Who will be on it? And how would a PERS beneficiary share their feedback with the advisory council would be helpful. Thank you for your time and attention to this important topic.
Thank you, Chair Samples, Treasurer Reed, and members of the Oregon Investment Council. My name is Sarah Wofford, and I'm the president of Oregon School Employees Association. And on behalf of over 24,000 OSEA represented classified school professionals and thousands of classified retired workers who support all levels of public education in all 36 counties of Oregon, including Head Start programs, K-12 school districts, education service districts, Parks and Rec, and community college. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to comment as you consider Treasurer Reed's decarbonization plan. Classified employees are a key group of frontline caregivers who support Oregon students, including some of the most economically and medically fragile. Most classified educators' wages are lower than the average annual PERS benefit, which was $33,550 in January of 2023, according to Treasurer Reed. For us, there is little room for error when it comes to PERS stability. The timeline that Treasurer Reed identifies in his plan provides a much more precautionary off-ramp to divestment of fossil fuels than the recent proposal considered during the 2023 legislative session that directed the state to divest from fossil fuels in less than a year. OSEA adamantly opposed that concept. By contrast, Reed's plan identifies 50% decarbonization across the whole state portfolio by 2035 and a net total portfolio level for all greenhouse gas emissions by no later than 2050. We appreciate that Treasurer Reed's more deliberate approach reflects his fiduciary responsibility to manage the funds that we as PERS beneficiaries trust the state to protect and nurture, just as we protect and nurture Oregon's future in educational facilities every day. The retirement funds you manage give us some peace of mind that someday we may actually be able to retire. Our wages are not high enough during our careers, but we get great satisfaction from our work. We choose this work based on the full employment package that includes both wages and benefits. Some, though not all of our members, are scheduled for enough hours over the years to vest in PERS so that we can look at statements and dream about tomorrow being a little brighter. The economic fragility of members, both while working in retirement, necessitates our concern that this more gradual transition could still endanger members' benefits. We appreciate Treasurer Reed naming the protection of members' retirement as a top priority throughout this process. And we understand that the plan's intention is to move away from fossil fuel assets that have diminishing reserves while gradually transitioning to renewables that are gaining greater value and stability, which avoids known risk. Unfortunately, we have lived through several periods of unexpectedly high economic instability, and as Oregon moves toward a reduced carbon portfolio, we must strongly advocate for ensuring the stability of the public returns to the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund. Those returns ensure economic future for our members and minimize the unfunded liability that drives public employer cost. We look forward to giving feedback on future iterations of the plan. We appreciate the Oregon Investment Council's expertise in identifying risks, economic uncertainty, and investment opportunities in a decarbonizing economy. Strong collaboration among us will best achieve a more stable, cleaner environment portfolio for Oregon and economic security for hardworking public servants. Thank you for the opportunity to submit testimony.
All right, next three speakers, Holly Oakes Miller, Susan Palmatier, and Andrew Bogrand. And I neglected to state before we started, Kevin had to leave for to testify before a legislative committee. He was not trying to avoid public comments, and Aline will also have to leave at 11, but she will dial in. So apologies in advance for the interruptions. Okay. Go ahead.
Good morning, council members and staff. I'll be speaking about the net zero plan. My name is Holly Oakes Miller. I am the Vice President of Political Action at American Federation of Teachers, Oregon, and an instructor at Portland Community College. I am here to represent our thousands of members in higher education, K through 12, and education workplaces across the state, the majority of whom are public sector workers and are or will be beneficiaries of the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund. We want to thank Treasurer Reed and his Chief of Staff, Dimitri Palmatier, for regularly meeting with our leaders to answer our questions and discuss our concerns as the net zero plan was being created. This plan is a huge step for Oregon in meeting the demands of the climate crisis, and we appreciate all the careful work that it took to get to this moment. We also look forward to continuing our collaborative relationship with the Oregon Treasury through the Net Zero Beneficiary Advisory Committee. As an active member of the Divest Oregon Coalition, AFT Oregon joins the call for the Oregon Investment Council to create OIC policy for the net zero plan as part of its review and evaluation process. This will ensure that implementation and oversight will proceed through changes of Oregon Treasury leadership and staff. We also want to urge the Oregon Treasury to publicly report on progress annually and for the Oregon Investment Council to review and update the plan no less than every 5 years, as recommended by the UN's Expert Group on Net Zero Emissions Commitments. While we believe that the Net Zero Plan is a crucial and much welcome step in decarbonizing the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, and we understand that it's a very complex process for the Oregon Treasury to undertake, we still worry for our students and the future generations that it doesn't go far enough, fast enough, to ensure that we meet global emissions targets and secure a livable planet for humans and all things. As a geology instructor, I regularly teach the science of global climate change, its current impacts, and the projections for the future. Often my students express hopelessness and despair about the climate crisis, about political leaders' lack of will to change our course quickly enough to avert the worst impacts, and about the bleak futures that they envision for themselves as a result. AFT Oregon members and our students know that climate change is an evolving crisis which we learn more about each and every day. The Net Zero Plan will be a learning process for the Oregon Treasury and OIC, and we are hopeful that this plan will provide the basis from which even more ambitious plans and targets can be developed, given what is learned along the way with respect to both implementation of the plan and the challenges of the climate crisis moving forward. Thank you for your time.
Hi, my name is Andrew Bogran. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm the Volunteer Communications Director for Divest Oregon. I would like to start by acknowledging the Oregon Investment Council, Pam Chair Samples, and the rest of you for allowing many hours of public testimony by Divest Oregon over the past several years on the risks of climate change on the Oregon State Treasury's returns. I would also like to thank Treasurer Tobias Reed and his Chief of Staff, Dimitri Palmatier, for their positive engagement with us over the past several months. Our goal has always been for Treasury to address the financial risks of climate change, and we are heartened that mitigating climate risk will now be Treasury policy. Continuing to build trust through public engagement and transparency, now and into the future, will be critical in ensuring that this net zero plan succeeds. Some will worry that the policies laid out in this plan will go too far in the pursuit of decarbonization and jeopardize returns. Others will worry that this plan will fall short of reducing fossil fuel risk. Regardless of any one position, everyone will need to know how this plan is being implemented. In the short term, this means providing clarity on how this plan will be launched over the next year. In my professional career, I've worked on transparency reforms at home and abroad. We know that transparency is key to building mutual trust and confidence, including when it comes to addressing climate risks and moving us closer to net zero emissions. Transparency is not just about providing information, but tracking goals, progress, and impacts. It is about building public trust. We urge you to consider how Treasury can build and maintain public trust in its net zero commitment. For one, the plan could use more clarity on how the OIC and the public will be kept up to date on progress and challenges. Information without engagement or zombie transparency is always a challenge. This plan must be a living document grounded in regular positive engagement with beneficiaries, stakeholders, and groups like Divest Oregon. In implementing this plan, Treasury should look to the UN High-Level Expert Group on Net Zero Emissions, which has published guidelines for net zero plans that include establishing and publishing a timeline and deliverables for implementing the plan, describing the project team tasked with implementing this plan, including key roles and responsibilities, and lastly, creating a comprehensive annual reporting template to credibly demonstrate progress and identify barriers on the road to net zero. We look forward to our future engagement as an ever-broadening coalition with the Oregon Investment Council and the professional Treasury staff, especially as this net zero plan is put into place. Let's do this the right way. Thank you.
My name is Susan Palmeter, for the record. I speak on behalf of Divest Oregon, a coalition of over 100 organizations and over 1,000 members. We commend the Treasurer for engaging and agreeing with us that climate change, one, poses a financial risk to our state's pension fund, and two, creates a need to mitigate that risk that it will have on beneficiaries' returns. The plan represents an important and significant policy shift for OPERF. This shift for the Oregon Treasury and OPERF, which as proposed will need to be sustained through the next few decades. A climate risk-aware staff that evolves over time with many newly elected treasurers and a newly appointed OIC members. And through those decades, which I and many people in this room may not live to see, unpredictable impacts of the unfolding climate crisis on financial markets will occur. As the Treasurer's plan acknowledges, the pathway that will optimally protect beneficiary returns from climate risk is unknown. If anything, the climate crisis is unfolding more quickly than scientists had expected. Faster warming, more severe weather events, look at California right now, and more rapidly approaching tipping points, all from which there is no return. At the same time, new pathways may appear so that OPERF can hit an 80% emission reduction by 2035 and net zero by 2040. Other public pension funds are moving to do just that. We hope that the Treasury can do as well. Therefore, we urge the OIC to unequivocally embrace this overall shift as OIC investment policy. Safeguarding the fund from climate risk should not be the job of a sole treasurer or the capable Treasury staff alone. It must be OIC investment policy to be credible and long-lasting. Only a policy can guide work, provide oversight, and create accountability. The OIC has statutory responsibility for the Oregon Treasury, as ORS 293.731 states, shall formulate policies for the investment of OPERF and acquisition, retention, management, and disposition of investments. Given the importance of this initiative, we ask that OIC members meet quarterly with the Treasury team responsible for implementing this work, similar to the quarterly asset class team meetings that you're starting now. We also ask that you request quarterly updates from the staff at OIC meetings, outlining the progress of the net zero plan so we are all informed of any slowdowns or stalls. The urgency is real. The time for action is now. The net zero plan is inherently a policy. We urge the OIC to take an active role both in overseeing the implementation of the plan and how urgently the staff is acting to proactively protect beneficiaries. It needs to be an OIC policy. Thank you for the opportunity and thank you for your volunteer work. We very much appreciate you.
Thank you. Okay, the next three speakers, Gary Walmark, Jennifer Schramm, and Nancy Yule.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members, council members. I'm Nancy Yule, and I'm speaking on behalf of Divest Oregon. I appreciate that the Oregon Treasury has developed this net zero plan. It's a foundational document that has potential to evolve into effective policy to mitigate the financial risks to OPERF from climate change. We all see climate change accelerating across Oregon and the planet. The truth is, this net zero plan will only be effective if it has the ability to evolve and meet the rapidly deteriorating situation we are in, and it's only as good as the financial models that are taking these changes into account. Foremost in your mind should be an understanding that current economic models used to model financial risk from climate change are not taking into account tipping points and cascades, nor the severe price adjustments that will reflect climate risk. Three professional articles in the past 7 months by economists and actuaries lay out the facts, and I'm happy to provide copies of them at your request. I also cite them in my written testimony. To summarize the findings, standard economic models fail to consider domino effects of tipping points and feedback loops, which climate science tells us are not far away, and their risks are accelerating. To understand tipping points and feedback loops, you need just imagine being on a road trip and having a hungry, tired child on board. You know problems are going to progress quickly, and the tipping point to no return is unpredictable and sooner than we hope. Then there's the domino effect. Once one passenger in the car starts to melt down, you know more will follow in a cascading manner. That's tipping point and feedback loop. Current economic models are also underestimating how quickly the planet is warming and burning through our carbon budget. And in the models, the measurement of costs from climate change damage are excluded many of the risks that are anticipated that arise from climate change. Even ORTEC, who did the economic modeling for Treasury in 21 and 22, think their model is underestimating financial damage because it's not accounting for tipping points or unprecedented changes in the climate system. Economists and actuaries are shouting to us that the impacts of climate change are much worse and happening much faster than financial models are predicting. The net zero plan must evolve to incorporate updated economic models that best reflect the rapidly changing climate. And the plan needs to keep looking for where you can accelerate the move to net zero. Thank you very much.
My name is Jennifer Schramm, and I am representing DeVest Oregon in this testimony. DeVest Oregon will follow the implementation of the Treasurer's plan in the coming months ahead and encourage improvements. As Andrew discussed, we assume that the Treasury will create public trust in the plan by making plan progress accessible to all interested parties. An example of a necessary improvement to the plan is incorporation of all emissions data. Currently, the plan does not require reporting on greenhouse gas pollution resulting from the use of OPIRF's fossil fuel investments, Scope 3 emissions. Instead, the baseline measures only emissions from the production of those fuels, Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. This unmeasured and unreported Scope 3 pollution has a huge impact on the climate and a huge impact on the risk to OPIRF investments. Again, this plan currently only measures pollution from the production of fossil fuels, not the actual and intended use of fossil fuels. This is like measuring cancer risk from cigarettes by measuring cancer risk from growing tobacco and operating cigarette factories, while totally ignoring the cancer risk caused by actually smoking the cigarettes produced by those investments. Treasurer Reed's plan on page 40 notes that, quote, as the standards and reporting improve around Scope 3, Treasury will look to incorporate that data into our decision-making, unquote. Some corporate reporting of Scope 3 emissions, including reporting for big oil, is available now. Why not use it? That is just one example of the need for ongoing updates of the plan. You can be sure that as the Treasury and the Oregon Investment Council inform the public how the plan...
I'm listening to the board meeting. Anyway, I just want
to... You can be sure that as the Treasury and the Oregon Investment Council inform the public how the plan and the coalition will keep how the plan and implementing policy evolve on key issues, the DeVest Oregon Coalition will keep an open door and continue to look for updates and improvements. Thank you.
My name is Gary Walmark. My wife Linda and I are PERS retirees. PERS member retirees from Eugene. I'm a volunteer for DeVest Oregon, concerned about the stability of our retirement system as the climate continues to change. I thank the Treasurer for presenting his net zero plan and the Oregon Investment Council for considering how Oregon can best transition toward greener, safer investments. I'm glad this proposal is being made now rather than after the next Treasurer comes into office. It's a blueprint we can start building upon immediately. Some might think, we got this covered. There's nothing more to do other than adopt this plan. But that would be a mistake. My wife and I spent the last 50 years hiking throughout the West. We heard a little about the prospect of climate change years ago, but was very distant. It wouldn't be a problem for generations. Then we started seeing things change, sometimes slowly, sometimes very rapidly. We planned a trip to Mount Rainier in the 80s to hike in the glacial ice cave. But the week before we left, the cave was closed. Car-sized ice chunks were falling from the ceiling. Surprise. As we returned to the park over the years, we saw the huge Nisqually Glacier keep receding up the mountain. It became difficult to see glaciers in Glacier National Park. Surprise. River levels were dropping. Rafting on the Colorado, we encountered a rapid that shocked our experienced guide. It hadn't been there in more than a generation and wasn't there just days before. Surprise. And large expanses of forest in Oregon and throughout the West are sick and dying. More wildfires, more smoke, more closed roads, more charred land, more burned communities. Surprise, shock, loss, and grief. The predictions were wrong. The Earth is heating faster than we expected. We feel and see it. Things that were supposed to happen in the future are happening now. Change is nonlinear. It's chaotic with sudden, unanticipated consequences. Surprise. This is no longer a problem only for remote future generations. It is our problem and will become an even bigger problem for our children and our grandchildren. No wonder the state has adopted policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. These accelerating disruptions are sapping our state retirement savings. The S&P 500 fossil fuel energy sector is worth barely more today than it was 10 years ago. Investments that once seemed sound may become costly stranded assets. Surprise and ouch. We don't want our portfolio to be filled with buggy whip investments. We would like the Treasury to divest now from fossil fuels, as a New York pension fund has done. But we are glad Treasurer Reid has taken the first step. We and other PERS members and retirees will watch how quickly Treasury implements the plan and watch how the next treasurer builds on it to protect our PERS investments. Far-sighted leadership will be required to avoid surprising ouches. Thank you.
Okay, three speakers. Alyssa Giacchino. And I can't tell, Susan Allen, were you speaking? Can't tell by your note if you left, okay. And Anya Cruz?
Good morning, council members and staff. Alyssa Giacchino with the Private Equity Stakeholder Project. As the human and economic costs of climate change accelerate, Treasurer Reid's net zero plan is a crucial step towards setting Oregon's pension system in line with the pathway to 1.5 degrees. We commend the treasurer for his leadership and appreciate the diligent work of his staff in developing a solution-driven approach to address climate risks in the OPERF portfolio. The Treasury's plan to set interim emissions reductions targets toward 2050 is key. The goal to cut emissions intensity by 60% by 2035 is reasonable, but we recommend you seek to accelerate that timeline. As a watchdog organization that focuses on private market asset managers, we're particularly interested in how these objectives will ensure laggard private equity and real asset managers rapidly cut emissions and transition away from the risks of fossil fuels. The Treasury has shown leadership by measuring baseline emissions across asset classes. We commend the inclusion of private markets. Notably, real assets and private equity made up 46% of OPERF's emissions as of the end of 2022, while they represented 35% of assets. The private funds industry has made insufficient progress in the energy transition, including major OIC investment managers like Blackstone, Brookfield, KKR, NGP, Global Infrastructure Partners, and NCAP. Private equity infrastructure firms hold billions in fossil fuel assets, including coal and gas power plants, pipelines, drilling operations. They are investing to expand fossil fuel infrastructure, including new drilling, pipelines, and LNG terminals, even as the International Energy Agency has called for no expansion of supply and predicts that demand for oil, gas, and coal will peak before 2030. I'd like to highlight some of the plan's key initiatives. It acknowledges that the largest portion of your financed emissions, estimated at 9.5%, come from natural gas and oil extraction, most of which is within real assets. To address that, the plan takes the sensible step of excluding new commitments to fossil fuel-focused private funds. The analysis is science-based and includes emissions intensity paired with absolute emissions metrics. The plan rightly calls for encouraging managers to set net zero targets and using your leverage as a $97 billion investor to push for credible transition plans from private market investments. It calls for aligning manager and fund selection with climate goals through diligence and data. And it establishes an engagement process with program participants through a new beneficiary advisory committee. Each of these initiatives are prudent steps to position the fund to mitigate climate risks in your portfolio. You must have clear guidance for private market managers to set expectations and consequences if they fail to achieve meaningful progress. We urge the council to adopt additional interim benchmarks ahead of 2035 to ensure progress stays on track with manager accountability and regular reporting. Thank you so much.
Hello, I'm Anya Cruz. I'm here to talk about divestment today. I'm a public employee and part of Colleagues in Solidarity organization. We're an organization working in solidarity with the Filipino people in their fight for land and livelihood. We have come today to raise our concerns for the third time about the effects of the Oregon Treasury's investments on the safety of the people and environment, particularly in the Philippines. Out of the approximately $100 billion PERS fund, five companies in the private investment portfolio, JPMorgan Chase, Tesla, Boeing, OceanaGold, and Teleperformance, we have seen to be incredibly damaging in the Philippines and across the globe. The Philippines holds enormous wealth in mineral, agricultural, and labor resources, yet the majority of people live in poverty. The profit-driven pursuit of resources like nickel, gold, silver, and other minerals in high demand pits the interests of corporations like OceanaGold and Tesla against indigenous people whose lives and livelihoods depend on the health of the land, which mining projects destroy. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan is the highest investor in fossil fuels in the world, and within the Philippines pushes through dirty oil and gas fields that continue to devastate the land. Teleperformance operates in the Philippines to exploit cheap labor to work in call centers serving other multinational corporations, and has ruthlessly attacked labor organizing efforts. One call center worker, Alex De Rosa, was killed for his activism in the Philippines. Activists who resist that would displace them from their lands are routinely harassed, jailed, and even killed by the Philippine government. Corporations like Boeing profit off the sale of weapons to the Philippine state to carry out repression, while the government is under investigation by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. The Philippines is one of the deadliest countries for environmental defenders in the world, and this is a direct result of the collusion between corporations, a corrupt Philippine government, and our government institutions. Investments in fossil fuel and other extractive industries not only contribute to the ever-worsening climate crisis, but are directly linked to ongoing human rights violations in the Philippines and many other countries around the world. Those who stand up to protect their land and human rights are publicly targeted, and this often leads to their murder, simply for defending the lands and community from destruction. Meanwhile, the people of the Philippines continue to resist plunder of their lands and labor. It is our duty to stand with them. We are here today demanding the Oregon Treasury stops its involvement in the continued plunder of the Philippines by divesting the PERS from the aforementioned corporations. The OIC's combined investment in these companies makes up only about $100 million, or roughly 1/1000th of the total fund. We demand an end to the complicity in the plunder of the Philippines as PERS recipients. Public employees in Oregon deserve a restful retirement that isn't predicated on the exploitation and suffering of people on their lands. Divesting is one crucial step we can take to combating climate change and environmental destruction, along with ensuring the rights of all peoples. Thank you.
Okay. This concludes our meeting. Thank you all for your engagement. Thank you, Treasurer Reed, for your presentation and your work. Thank you, folks from McKenzie. I'm sure we'll all be following up with you. As we've stated in the meeting, this is the first step on a long journey. And so I'm sure we'll be back in touch with everyone over the coming meetings about next steps as a council, as well as next steps from staff and other interested parties. Thank you. We are adjourned.